Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Oscar-nominated Australian-born editor Paul Matchless ACE. We'll be talking about his latest collaboration with director Edgar Wright, Last Night in Soho. Paul last chatted on Art of the Cut when he edited Wright's Baby Driver, for which he won a BAFTA and was nominated for an Ace Eddie and an Oscar. Paul was also nominated for an Ace Eddie for his work on Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. He's edited dozens of musical specials, documentaries, and concerts for the likes of Led Zeppelin, Diana Krall, and in a lot of TV, including Fleabag. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. One of the things that I really liked was the pace of the opening cab ride in London and the discomfort and the danger that kind of set up for the lead character, Ellie. Can you talk to me about that scene?
I mean, I think that scene was kind of designed as the first real instance of something kind of being not right or kind of laying the foundations for the troubles that potentially await our protagonist in Soho. I think Edgar has such a reputation for a lot of comedy in his films. I think if you're an Edgar Wright fan, but maybe you don't know a lot about what you're going into, what we've actually found on the screenings that I've been to in the last couple of weeks, that the audience laugh quite strongly at the first scene with Eloise and her gran, and they take these kind of subtle comedy lines, these light jokes, and there's like a few big laughs. It's Edgar, it's going to be comedy. And I think actually, funny enough, then it is that first scene in the taxi cab where actually the score gets a little darker. We're actually driving into Soho, and you'll notice it kind of goes from kind of early evening into dusk, and it gets darker as well by the time she gets out. It was kind of all designed to make you feel, oh, okay, not only is this going to be unlike any kind of Edgar Wright film that I've seen before, but now we're going to start telegraphing a few of these points to make you realize that actually there's going to be a little bit of danger ahead. The moment she gets into Soho, the moment Eloise gets into Soho, it just starts to go a little dark. It starts to go a little funny. It almost immediately is not what she expected London to be. A lot of that preempts what will happen to her, her attitude of ultimate escapism, initially from where she's sleeping, like her student digs, to where she moves into with Miss Collins on Goode Place. She can indulge in another form of escapism, of getting away from one environment into another. But like her real environment, that also, you know, holds dangers in it as well.
It also sets up the theme of the rest of the movie.
Absolutely. That threat level starts maybe initially just from a cabbie who possibly himself isn't realizing the extent of what he's doing, or indeed maybe he is. That danger element, that red light going off, is already starting to flash for Eloise at that point.
When you realize that that's the intent of the scene, that it does something for you as an editor, that you're intentionally making certain kinds of edits to amplify that?
Oh yeah, getting to the right point where you punch in to really emphasize the concern and her kind of perceived threat level. The fact that we kind of take a darker turn through some of the Soho streets and the footage gets a little bit more intense. That's probably the first scene where actually leading up to the moment where she says, I'll get out here. It's the first time that we kind of ramp up the kind of cut level as well in terms of the intensity of the editing. Before then, it's almost restrained and flowing, you know, the scenes outside her grandmother's cottage and on the train ride. And so it's the first time I think that really the editing can help emphasize the threat and the potential jeopardy that she's under.
Can you talk about the value of pre-lapping music starting it right at the end of one scene and moving it into the other instead of starting the music in the next scene?
Well, I'm a big fan of pre-lapping, as indeed is Edgar, because not only does it very smoothly join two scenes together or incoming sound effects, especially sound effects for one of Edgar's films, where you think you're hearing something in your outgoing scene, but actually it's a noise to do with the incoming scene. But what is great is, of course, is that the fact that we've got this Dick Dale kind of guitar coming in onto Soho, it just not only emphasizes the realization that the girls think they're going for a great night out, but already that can kind of signal a slightly evil undertone, because it then takes that outgoing scene, and then when you realize, then it telegraphs their journeys through the Soho streets, ending up at the Toucan pub. So you kind of feel like there's excitement, but there's an undercurrent there. So even though we're using that cue to take us through the girls' first big night out in Soho, to tie it in with a clink of the glass kind of makes you realize that even then, what's going to happen to the girls is not what they think might happen. And it's just a little emotional thing. And I think it's Edgar who has lined a lot of these cues and songs up, you know, months before we shoot. I think it's the way he's kind of put the tapestry together of his perception of the sound design, knowing that when you go to Soho, and rather than something gentle or even something that is even like underscore, it's a pretty full-on sound, that kind of guitar. And so I think what it also helps do is maintain an intensity level, because once she steps through into the 60s, whether it's in color or whether it's in sound or, you know, lighting or the speed of editing or the nature of the photography or the characters, everything is ramped up a notch, basically. And then by the end, several notches, as all those various elements are designed to kind of interplay and kind of at the end present you with a bit of a psychedelic overload.
There's a great, you could call it a smash cut, you could call it an answer cut, where like something that is spoken in one scene gets answered at the cut of the next scene. And there's a point where Ellie says, "I would never disappear in the middle of the night." Cut to her disappearing in the middle of the night.
Oh, absolutely. That was very much planned. What was interesting was it was actually the start of a longer scene. You know, Miss Collins, "I would never do that." Smash cut to her walking down the corridor laden with her suitcase and little record player. But then actually there was a whole bit where she bumps into John, her co-student, sort of saying, you know, "Where are you going?" And it was a kind of a comedy scene. You know, we watched it once or twice. You might have even had a preview screening with it, and then we just thought, do you know what? It just gets in the way of the finality of that cause response moment. All you really need, you know, she's on her way. And in fact, it actually improved so much, the fact that we took out that little interim scene of her trying to get her suitcase all the way back down the stairs out of the student digs and encountering John. All you need to know is she's out. She's kind of done the one thing she said she wouldn't do. And then the next shot, of course, is that kind of sweeping crane, which goes up to her attic bedroom. And of course, for the first time, introduces the neon, which is almost a character in its own right, really, the lighting in this film. If the cut is telling you it looked good on paper, but just as that scene stands, really, less is more. And you should just be very prepared to go, you know what? Let's let it go. Because you try and give every scene its moment. But I think there's a point where if you're trying to edit to it and there's always an element of frustration, it's not quite sitting the way you want it to. The kind of weight taken off your shoulders, when you say, well, what's it like without? And the first time you have it without, and as I said, you go from Ellie going down the university corridor to her outside Gooch place, and you go, that's it. That all the information is there. Great. Plus, of course, it's a nice way of just losing one extra minute of duration as well. People are, I think, very aware of running times. And I think that's something also as an editor, you should just be aware of, you know, where the various acts start and stop and what is a good running time for a film. I'm a big fan of the phrase, just because you can doesn't mean you should. You know, having set up the Eloise character and her adventures in coming to London, there's a point where you go, you know what? Roughly 24, 25 minutes in, we have to be at that first dream sequence. So the very first thing we cut was the first dream sequence with the Café de Paris and meeting Jack. We then immediately jumped to the Rialto where Anya Singh's downtown for her audition. And so we actually spent the first 5 or 6 weeks getting those right, because they kind of were going to be what they were in terms of storytelling, in terms of the dance that they do at the Café de Paris. It was designed as a one-er It wasn't designed to be cut down. We kind of knew that whole sequence was going to be what it was. And so we basically had these scenes that we were very, very happy with, of all these kind of key moments. So we then kind of edited the scenes around the set pieces. We kind of got an understanding of where things should happen and when, you know, scenes leading up to the first dream, how long it should roughly take. I mean, I remember watching a very early cut and watching those set pieces, but kind of feeling, you know what, it feels a bit episodic. And I remember after an early watch, just being very conscious of not making it feel like the set pieces are just clunking in, that you were just suddenly in, oh, right, here's another piece, without either time to breathe or time for the rest of the story to kind of move in tandem with those moments. We worked quite hard to make sure that the flow was there. When we first got to Diana Rigg, we kind of realized that even though the story of Eloise going and meeting Jocasta and the other students is good, the first time you see Diana and she takes you up the stairs and talks you through her apartment, you go, whoa, okay, the film is lifted at that point. And you don't want to wait too long for that to happen. Having lifted it up one level, you know now that it's going to jump up a quantum leap on the first flashback. And suddenly when we see her in the Haymarket at the Café de Paris, you want to make those steps gradual and effective. You want to ramp to those moments rather than jump to those moments.
When you were trying to get to those set pieces, you didn't want them to feel like a page turn, you know, with some pages missing. What were some of the things that you did to help achieve that?
In the pacing, in the scenes around those set pieces, we're going to kind of give the audience a bit of a breather between those big key moments. The story is going to carry on, but maybe you just ease back on the pacing and you don't rush forward. You know, there have been a few people who have kind of commented this, that, oh, it's the editing, like certainly in the first 20, 25 minutes is very unlike Edgar's kind of films, because people normally think the opening scene of Baby Driver or kind of the start of Scott Pilgrim or the opening montage in The World's End. It starts at a pretty intense level. It really couldn't be more gentle or more different an approach. That was part of the fun as well, actually, for us in our approach of saying, you know what, we're going to do a different kind of Edgar film. And certainly in the influences that we kind of took, not only the editing style, but the shooting style as well, there are some sections where it's unlike an approach that Edgar's done before. And I think that makes for something completely distinctive, because, you know, you know when you see those bits, it's 100% Edgar. But I think it's those bits around that actually you could afford to take time with and just have those little elements play. They're just as important as the big set pieces. So give them some time and then just make sure you're transitioning in and out of those the set pieces to those other kind of dramatic scenes has its own little tempo as well.
You mentioned the dance. Are you saying that the dance where Ellie and Anya go in and out, that was supposed to be a oner?
That is actually one unbroken, in-camera, unedited take. On a few reviews, I very unfairly and totally wrongly get the credit for, because, oh, the editing's amazing, how the editor's able to cut from one to the other. No. I put that down to our choreographer, Jen White, the remarkable work of Thomason, of Anya, of Matt Smith, and absolutely not last and least, the other invisible dancer that you don't see but is absolutely there, our wonder Steadicam operator, Chris Bain, who's basically doing just as much of a dance behind the camera as the girls are in front. That was rehearsed, choreographed. I think we shot the whole thing about 12 to 14 times. We actually thought there might be some bits. There were invisible bits. We'd kind of put in some moments where Edgar and I thought, well, you know what? If the first half of that is good and the second half of that one's good, well, we can find a smooth way to transition. And it could even be that maybe we did experiment with that at one point. But you know what? The beauty of that moment is something I can take absolutely no credit for. And the fact that it is a single unbroken take done in camera. And actually, I think when you get to see the making of there, and there's some wonderful behind the scenes stuff of just watching how the girls are prepping for their turn going into Matt and then out again. It's stunning stuff and brilliantly choreographed and brilliantly performed.
Fairly early in the movie, the audience realizes this is a mystery. Then you have to pace that out, right? Talk to me a little bit about pacing the mystery itself.
On Eloise's first couple of bouts of escapism, she's loving it because she sees this young wannabe singer who is romanced by this guy, Jack. And then the next time around, she's auditioning. And then I think it's the third time around, she realizes exactly what Jack has set her up for. And as Eloise's thoughts kind of turn to disgust and she wants to leave, she realizes she can't leave. She's now in this world, and the world is now telling her where she's going to go. So that's where it starts getting interesting editorially, because then you have the thing about suddenly you're in a kind of Alice in Wonderland way. You are suddenly transitioning from one environment, from one set, from one location to the next in a very non-standard, non-linear kind of way, with doors which open up into unexpected areas. And when they close, when you cut to the reverse, it's something else yet again. And that was a lot of fun to do. That was where editing could certainly kind of play its part, where it starts getting kind of hallucinatory in a sense, to enhance the levels of mystery. Later on, I mean, it gets a little more traditional when you're kind of at the police station and there's the Q&A at the point where you kind of think Eloise is on the edge of totally losing her mind. There you want to kind of emphasize that basically she's trying to remain calm, but you just figure there's a girl totally on the edge here. Not only did Thomason offer up an incredible performance, but it's being judicious about those moments you go back to her when she's answering a question, when she's considering options, because she offers you so much with so few gestures, because it's all there in her face and in her eyes. It's something that Edgar and I took a long time to go through to get the right level of character embellishment there, to make sure, you know, we were really feeling what she was feeling at that point, to enhance the mystery and to enhance the psychosis embedded in her character as well.
If you haven't seen the movie yet, you're getting the idea that these two characters, Ellie and Sandy, are kind of intertwined. At one point, during this downtown scene where she's auditioning, it seems like we're just watching Sandy. Two gentlemen are watching her audition and she's auditioning. The next thing you know, Ellie is in the scene. What made you decide when to go to Ellie?
Well, one thing we did, particularly in this film, and certainly where the songs were related, unlike, say, Baby Driver, where we had a lot of animatics about where car crashes and various actions should take place within the course of a song, we actually had every track broken down by the music department, Steve Price, the composer, and his incredible kind of musical associate, Bradley Farmer, who basically broke down musically, verse, chorus, duration-wise, minute and second-wise, broke that down for us to almost every word and every phrase. And so we kind of go, okay, so really there's a pan that's going to occur at that point. Having set up enough of the song and Sandy starts singing Downtown and we get some reactions there. And once again, it's one of those things that, you know, the camera's doing a lot of flowing movements. So, you know, the camera really never stays still in that scene. So really it's what you think is just, you know, an over-shoulder shot of Sandy singing and there are the two gentlemen. And it's just doing a fairly innocent pan behind Anya. And then there, of course, suddenly is Eloise. And she's just kind of magically there. But what we did is we made sure that we worked out beforehand at which point in that song those moments would occur. So we kind of work out a beat sheet for every one of those things. And you would say to me, okay, we want to start this shot, third line of the second verse. And then I would communicate that to Pete Blackshill, who was our playback operator. So he would put the right pips in. He would put four pips in, which not only would cue the actor, but would cue the cameraman as well. So the operator would know when to start the move. And we would time it and say, okay, count 10 seconds. And so by the time you hear this word, you want to be at your B position on the frame. So you want to take so long to actually achieve the pan. We use that technique throughout all the dream sequences, especially when it came to the programming of all those flashing neons. I don't know if you notice, it's a subtle thing, of course, but every time she goes to sleep, listening to one of those songs on her little record player, the neon lights from the restaurant next door always kind of magically in time, in tempo. But let me tell you, that just doesn't happen. You know, that there once again was a lot of prep. And that's a whole other thing as well about how editorially we were able to coordinate camera, lighting, and music. That's actually, for me, something I'm incredibly proud of.
I wrote down, can't sleep here, sound effects rhythm. There was a great musicality to it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think that's something that Steve Price, the composer, did a wonderful thing to. Steve's contribution, I can't speak highly enough of. We did an interesting thing on this film. Normally, the composer, having got an idea of the story and having maybe seen some dailies and things, offers you up some temp tracks, just ideas. Here's five or six tracks for you to have a play with as you start your edit. But this time Steve did something very different, which Edgar and I hadn't done before. Normally when you get a demo track, it's all mixed. You get a stereo track and it's there for you to use and you can edit it, do with it anything you want. What Steve offered up this time were actually the Pro Tools multi-tracks, which we loaded into the Avid. So I had a finished piece of music, but I had it on 16 individual tracks with all the individual instrumentation on each, which is something we hadn't done before. Sometimes you can find really fascinating things if you kind of start muting tracks, bit of orchestration. And there was one cue that we had. It was a big, intense, busy cue. It was fantastic. But we started pulling things out one by one until we were left with three little piano notes. Three small notes from this huge score, three small notes. And we just kind of listened to that. And Edgar kind of said, God, I think we've almost found the musical motif for this film. And in actual fact, that's very true. That's the first thing you hear. As soon as the first Universal logo or Focus Features logo comes up, you will hear these three notes, which are basically all that was left of this huge track that Steve wrote. Now, of course, you give that back to Steve and say, listen, I know you did this amazing job, but we just love these three little piano notes. And he goes, great, let me start with that. And now I'll build a new cue, which begins like that. And then I can embellish it with other little subtle sounds and effects like that. And that was brilliant, just to discover a cue within a cue or a motif within a cue by just Steve allowing us to say, yeah, take the multi-tracks, you know, tear them apart, find whatever you like.
Yeah, the sound design to me really amped up how frightening it was, for sure.
Oh yeah, Edgar is a master at sound design and the way sound works, and always has been since I worked with him back in, you know, in Spaced, the sitcom series we did more than 20 years ago now. And so I think for something like this, where to get a haunting, unsettling feeling, sound plays so much of a part in that. You know, even before we've shot a frame, he's got his sound team and saying, these are the concepts that I'm thinking of. Here's some of the test footage that we've got of the Shadow Men and various other things.
So many of these scenes that Edgar does seems very well planned. He knows what it can look like. He can probably imagine the edit in his head, but he probably wants something very different from you, a different look at it.
Yes, I mean, there is that thing where he brings me in, I think on Soho, I came in about a month earlier. There were a couple of animatic scenes and a couple of ideas about, you know, what he'd like the lights to do and the flashing of the red, white, blue to the red, red, red. I mean, part of that, though, too, is like, you know, this is what I'd like to do. I've got no idea how to accomplish it. Guys, I just need us to all kind of knock our heads together to get these looks in. He really set himself and us a challenge with the kind of flashing neon, because if you think about it, those lights always have to go in sequence. They're always red, white, blue. But if you're trying to edit dialogue, you know, you're trying to work out the cut, the best cut, the best take. Not only are you trying to think of the best take and the best shot, but even when you find the best one, you're kind of going, oh, right. So what are the lights doing at this point? Are we going to go? Because we can't go from white to white, can we? No, that cut, right. So, you know, so suddenly you find yourself, as Edgar's actually said a couple of times, who was the idiot that's come up with this idea? You go, oh, yes, of course, it's me. You know, and the thing you learn about doing an idea like this is never do an idea like this again. But the incredible thing is, it's just like, okay, that's the challenge he set us up to. We can't just ignore it, because actually, if you don't get the lighting right, that's part of the story. That's, as I said earlier, it's a character. It's a signifier. You've got to get that right. Part of it was like, okay, this is the last setup we did. Okay, this Edgar quite likes this take. Right. So I would look at the cut on my little Avid trolley and go, right, so what's the, okay, so the last one, red, the last big color was red. So it means the next color has to be white. But you can't just hit play or roll the camera and the color will be white. So there were a few moments where I would stand next to Edgar. I would watch the color go, you know, kind of go through its sequence. And as it would approach the right one, the right color, I would then go to Edgar and 3, 2, 1. So then Edgar would go action. And so when he went action on, whereas the previous light switched off, as the actor or actress started to talk, the correct light would go. You know,
I know.
And you can imagine the great fun of going, oh, no, okay, that's the wrong one. Okay, let's do it again. We've got to wait for the red. The next one's the red. And I can't tell you how much fun that was then to try it in the edit, let alone shooting it correctly, editing it correctly. So I think we've well and truly said editing with sequential neon lights has been done. Please don't try it at home, because you'll only give yourself an aneurysm. But I have to say, you know, we sweated a lot for that. but it worked.
So you were editing as you were on Baby Driver, you were on set.
On set, yeah. And in fact, actually, I would say maybe 80% on Baby Driver, this time 100%. So, you know, whenever we were doing all that running through Soho streets and Carnaby Street in the West End, I'm just out of shot somewhere with a little leather trolley trying to maintain, you know, she's running at the right length of time because, of course, I've got the song, the bit of music laid up on one of the tracks on the Avid, and I know where I have to be at some point. So I go, okay, so really I've got 53 seconds. So Edgar can do kind of whatever he likes in this 53 seconds as long as I get to that point, you know, and make sure all that works. And so that was all integral as well. So I think Edgar and I took a lot of the lessons that we learned from Baby Driver and applied them in this way, in a much less subtle way. You know, there's not a lot of car crashes and things, big hammering sounds happening on the beat. But in terms of syncing up lighting and, say, motion control cameras and that kind of thing, I mean, really, that was some of the things that were the most satisfying about taking, you know, elements to sync things up. But at the end of the day, this time, just to make it look imperceptible. I think Baby Driver, you know, the editing was kind of capital E editing, waving its flag, saying a little bit, hey, look at me, you know, because a lot of people actually notice the editing on Baby Driver, and fair enough. This time around, it wasn't so much that, but it still had a lot of that kind of techniques running underneath it all to make sure all that stuff just ran smoothly. We do these kind of little interstitial edits where we kind of revisit little shots, little moments of what happened in her past. Although, interestingly, if memory serves, we never actually use the same bit of footage. I think what we do is whenever we do one of those little flashback shots, we use a different take of the same action, just in that sense that, you know, you remember things a little bit differently from when they actually happened. They're close, but they're not quite. So every little, you know, remembrance of hers is actually an alternate take of the one that was actually in the scene. But then I remember as well that what Edgar did is he shot some very odd angles. If you notice that, we kind of slightly, in some respects, disregard the line, and we've got some very weird over shoulders, which emphasize quite a bit of negative space in the frame to potentially, you know, underline her kind of jagged sense of mind at this point. And also, I remember too, finding very non-standard places to place the edit. Even on a three-handed interview, it's not necessarily the traditional kind of way you would cut. Sometimes it's on a gesture. And if it is on a gesture, it might be on an angle or on a line that you wouldn't normally go to. Once again, it's a subtle thing, but it's there if you want to see it. The camera angle and the nature of the cutting is just slightly schizophrenic as well, just to chime in with what's going on in her head at that point.
What kind of conversations were there of, okay, the audience knows what's up now. We need to, in the words of Joe Walker in his interview the other day, get a wiggle on. We know what's going on, so now we need to get to the end of the movie, or no?
To a degree, having kind of set some of that up, I mean, I guess in that sense, you do want to get a wriggle on. But I mean, I guess too, one point is that we have those several storylines to try and get a successful conclusion to. Each needs their moment to resolve, and each needs to work in the context of the other. Because what you don't want to have is a film and where you sort of think, oh, great film, but it just kind of had four endings, one after the other. And I think one of the tricks for us as well is to make sure all that stuff is kind of integrated. And I think once again, that's the clever bit of Edgar and Christie's writing, that also along with the visual element, that they're all still kind of circling each other's characters and stories. But I think there's a nice way where we've been able to deal with each story and gently bring it back down to earth without a kind of clunkiness.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the trick. How can we efficiently get the audience where they are happy with the conclusion of the movie?
Absolutely. Very much so. Very much so.
Wonderfully done. All right. I've kept you quite long enough. I know you've got a ton of things to do. I want to thank you so much for joining me and talking about Last Night in Soho.
Oh, you're incredibly welcome. Thank you for asking, Stephen.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to my guest, Paul Matchless, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition, and thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.